Mr. Greenhalgh, Shreel 7.
Despite this victory parade, I felt it was necessary to bring some sort of reality back, that one victory doesn't make the end of the war. It was a strategic victory, yes, but then we must be prepared for a long, hard fight ahead. And this was the sort of message that I was then passing out, which I remained with the after part as political commissar until probably May, June 38.
Were you political commissar only to the transport drivers?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've been working in the political commissariat when I was printing the newspaper. You know, that... And I was secretary to George Aitken, who was the brigade commissar. So if he wanted... Like, when Nathan died, George gave the funeral oration, and he prepared that in the truck, we lost the truck, we were now in a little office in a house, and he prepared his statement, and I typed it out and printed it on a sort of duplicator that they had in the headquarters, because by then George was back in Brigade HQ, and I was then his secretary. So, I'd been sort of on the political side ever since Harama, or rather after Halkaladi and Aries, when Pete was taken away into hospital, and Pete Jansen was taken away into hospital. And as I say, I remained with them until, I think it must have been May, and I was told that I was being sent back to England. And, I was the last of the first company. I'd been there longer than anybody else. I was the last of the first company, because I'd been there since November 36. And... I could now go home.
How did you react to it?
I was very pleased. I knew that the war was coming to an end anyway. I mean, I had been reading the newspapers, seeing the way in which the non-intervention committee was moving towards persuading the Spanish government to withdraw the international brigades on condition that the Germans and the Italians would withdraw theirs. Now, there was no problem about the Italians being withdrawn because they'd already gone. They'd already lost very heavily at Guadalajara, and therefore they had very little further to do. But the Germans were now taking over the battle, and the battles of the Aragon Front were mainly... There were largely German troops, German tanks, German aircraft. And there was talk then of this peace treaty which could be agreed when the foreign troops, including the International Brigade and the Germans and the Italians, were withdrawn, leaving the Spaniards to fight to come to an agreement. I couldn't see this. I couldn't see this developing. But when they said, we're going to send you back to England, we want you to go back to England and take part in a propaganda tour, speaking at meetings about what's happening, raising again the question of arms for Spain and the legitimacy of the Spanish government and so on. So I wasn't going home, I was being sent on a propaganda tour, which is what I did when I got back to England.
Just before we go back to England, I got the impression when you were talking about the roles that you carried out as a political commissar, that it was the emphasis was on the welfare side,
yes,
rather than the propaganda side.
The emphasis was on the welfare side insofar as the physical things we did. But always, always we were emphasising what we were, who we were, and why we were there. You know, so...
And you said it was like a padre in the British Army.
Except that we had this mission of internationalism, which we had to... The international solidarity against fascism. We were preaching anti-fascism. You know, there was nothing else. That was the way in which we... Well, let us say, that was the way I saw my role. Because I've often been asked about this question of communist control and thought control in the International Brigade. Because it has been said that in the other units of the brigades, there was very, very severe thought control by the political commissars. Now, I was, a lot of the time, I was simply carrying out my own judgment, my own knowledge. I wasn't receiving any political training or political instructions from anybody. Even when I was with George, he never queried any particular line that I wrote in the newspaper, you know. He never tried to insist that I put this in. If he wanted something in, all right, you do it, George, and I'll, you know, you write it and I'll put it in. You see, so that what George wrote in there was in George's name. What I wrote in there was nobody's name. It just went in, you know. And we did have other people writing in. Maybe because all my political philosophy was developed as I was there, because I didn't have a great deal of it before I went. A lot of it developed while I was in Spain. Maybe it was this which made me antipathetic to the Americans, you know, because I did not like their particular way of doing things. And it's true that I developed a political philosophy in Spain, which has been with me the rest of my life. That's how it was in the British Army. I was exactly the same in the British Army. The same things happened to me in the British Army as happened to me in Spain. I was in a place they wanted a job doing, I did the job. But that was all, you know. And later on, I'll tell you something about my British Army career and let you see how this whole thing all developed.
Now, you were talking about having to go back to conduct propaganda on behalf of Spain. Was it easy to get back to Britain?
Oh, no, it was no problem whatsoever. I just, they showed me a room, and in there were lots of clothing. Obviously, people who'd come to Spain had changed into uniform. Later on, you see, there was uniforms, there was organisation and so on. So they left their civilian clothes, they'd been killed, and it was there, go inside there, pick yourself a civilian suit. If there's a suitcase in there, I brought my uniform home with me. And used it when I went hiking as a, you know, sort of took all the badges and things off. And had this thing with the bulging pockets as a, you know, when I used to go hiking afterwards. I went to, got a truck, went into Barcelona, reported to an office, was given a hotel room, spent 3 days in, there's two of us, another Englishman, I couldn't think of his name. I'm not sure who this other person was. It could have been Ted Bramley, who was the London District organizer of the Communist Party, because he came home at the same time. I remember seeing Ted Bramley, but it could have been somebody else. There was just two of us. We got, we went the same way that we came in. We went to Portbou, we got the little railway train, went underneath the Pyrenees, got a train at Perpignan, arrived in Paris, went to an office in Paris, got some French money, and we went out for a meal. First meal we'd had for a long, long time, because the food in Spain was very largely still only chickpeas and pimiento and things of that kind. Got a train, came back to England, arrived in Victoria, a bit late at night, so somebody took me home, gave me a bed, and the next morning I got a train and went back to Manchester. Nobody waiting for me. Went home. My sister was rather surprised to see me. She hadn't heard that I was coming home. Nobody knew I was coming home. And after a few days, I was asked to go along to the party office, and they showed me a list of meetings. And these were mainly Labour Party meetings, not Communist Party meetings, Labour Party meetings, at which I was simply being introduced as one who'd been to Spain and could give the latest information. And of course, my latest information always was the basis that the sacrifice that's being made is more than is necessary, because they are having to sacrifice bodies where they ought to have arms. If there was arms, the sacrifices would not be as great. But sometimes we were fighting with only a rifle, whereas the other people were fighting with tanks and aircraft and everything else. You know, this was the main gist of what I was saying.
Do you think it was fair enough to make that point? Do you think it was fair enough to make that point?
Oh, I think it was absolutely true, you know, because we didn't have anything to fight with. And then one evening I went to a theatre in Ashton, and the other main speaker was Adam Swaffer. And Adam Swaffer was telling the people that the war in Spain was over. No, that the Republic didn't stand on earth, that soon they would have to admit defeat, and so on and so forth. And this incensed me so much that I interrupted him and said, "Don't take any notice of this coward. We can still win. Give us the arms and we'll still win." And of course I was bundled off and I didn't go any more meetings.
Who bundled you off?
Oh, the steward, you know, the chairman, because it was a Labour Party meeting, and Alan Swaffer, I mean, I was only just a nobody, young nobody, and he was Alan Swaffer of the Daily Herald. I didn't do any more big meetings. I wasn't diplomatic.
So was that the end of your campaign?
The war ended, the lads came home, but I felt that the lads were given a raw deal. You know, they were fated for a few days, but then that was all, you know, and that was that. And so I fell out with the Communist Party because of that.
Because of
I
what?
I wasn't going to be used anymore, you know.
Why did you fall out with them?
On the fact that I felt that they just used the point of the lads coming home and not looked after them sufficiently well after that. You know, they sort of ignored them. There's another battle to fight, so, you know, that's it, you know. And I still think that they should have been given a lot more support, a lot more mental and moral support, because I mean, we'd all been through a lot, you know, and yet in many ways, there were cynics in the party who thought that we were sort of just going out there for the glory.
Did anybody just go out for the adventure?
If they did, they deserted, because it was a tough time. And there were desertions, there were lots of desertions. So those who went out for the adventure were either killed or they deserted, or they found that there was more than their adventure when they got there. You know, I never regretted going there. As I say, I regretted the way in which we were treated afterwards. And I fell out with the Communist Party. And
what form did your falling out take?
Just insofar as I just didn't offer my services in any way to all to the meetings and so on that were being. I sort of faded out into the background.
So it was about the handling of the returning IB fighters.
It wasn't the fact of the IB itself. No. I mean, the kind of sacrifice which I found in the brigade wasn't here in England. It seemed that there were people who were using it from a safe seat in England. You know, that kind of thing seemed to me. And
using it in what way?
In that they were getting themselves nice little jobs organising the. For instance, I told you about this sports that we used to have in Plattfields as YCL. Well, there was to be a sports meeting at the YCL, and challenge was to. Challenge sometimes appeared in cycle style form, and sometimes it was printed. And for the sports day, there was to be a 4-page spread inside printed, which would be pre-printed. And this was to have the programme of events, but in order to pay for it, we would need to have adverts. And so I was asked to approach various people to get adverts for this. And one of the people I was asked to go to was Clem Beckett's widow. Clem Beckett had been killed at an armour. Clem Beckett had a motorcycle repair shop on Oldham Road near where I lived. And his widow was still keeping the shop going. And so I was asked to go and persuade her to take out a block advert in this. And I said no. And as an idea, I'm not going to ask a widow to take out an advert and spend money on an advert. If you like, you can send somebody else. But I'm not going to use the International Brigade and the pride she felt in her husband to persuade her to take out an advert. And, if you want to be funny that way, all right, I'll go, etc., you know, but I think it's stupidity and so on, you know. And to me, it was something serious, and probably the beginning of my disillusionment, you know, with the way in which I found things afterwards. There were other things like that that I found which I really didn't like, you know.
That meeting where you criticised Hannon Swaffer, was that 38 or 39, do you think?
Oh, that must have been 38, because, as you know, we came out in 38, in October 38, the brigade was withdrawn. So it must have been towards August, September, something like that, 38.
In Ashton?
In Ashton.
Did you suffer any discrimination after Spain because of having been in the International Brigade, for example, in the British Army?
Oh, yes, they knew that I was a primitive anti-fascist. In fact, they used to joke about the fact that I was primitive anti-fascist.
Who did?
Oh, You know, I told you that later on I became part of the personnel selection department in the War Office. And I worked in the War Office and I was on very, very good terms with Colonel Ogerson, who was in charge of the development of personnel selection. He and I used to get on very well. And he used to joke about the idea that, I mean, there was a time when they needed to send a team, a specialist personnel selection team, to India. So Ogerson said, "Oh, what about you?" So I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, you have to go to Ogtu and become an officer, and then we'll send you." So I said, "Well, do you think they'll allow me?" "Ah," he said, "I never thought of that. I'll find out, you know." And then he came back, he said, "No," he said, "you're a premature anti-fascist and it won't do."
Did he use that phrase?
He used that phrase, premature anti-fascist. The other occasion was that in the army they used to have the meetings. What did they call these special meetings when the FTR or something?
ABCA
meetings. Well, I was forbidden to attend ABCA meetings.
Who forbade you?
The officer in charge. You know, just told me quite friendly, it would be a good idea if you didn't go to ABCA meetings and only get yourself in trouble.
He was in charge of the ABCA meetings?
Yes. He said, "You'll only get yourself in trouble." No. See, very briefly, what happened was this in the British Army. I was called up in July 1940 and went to the Royal Signals training in Trowbridge in Yorkshire. And I was to be trained as a special service operator, wireless operator. Now this was not an ordinary wireless operator, but one eavesdropping on enemy communications. And so we had to learn, first of all, how to take down the Morse code very fast, and in addition, to learn enemy procedures, so that you knew which were the procedure signals and which were the message signals and so on.
So you were meant to be in the Y service?
Yes. So I finished my training and was qualified as special service operator, special operator radio, you see. And Sunday morning, went to a church parade. Then after church parade, we went into Trowbridge to have a cup of tea and so on. And in this cafe, I collapsed and was rushed up to hospital. I don't know whether I had a tummy bug or what, but I was kept in hospital for about a week. And when I left, the unit I was with had already embarked for Singapore. And I was left out on a limb, so I was whitelisted. And in those days, whitelisting meant that you go into a special camp and then somebody decides to send you off to so-and-so. So I went in there as a wireless operator, and so I was pushed off to an infantry brigade as an ordinary signals operator. Now it took them 3 weeks before they found out that I was a special operator and not a signals operator. I couldn't send Morse for traffic, I couldn't send it. I'd never been taught to send it, but I'd been taught to listen to it. So they sent me back again to wireless, and then they sent me up to Scotland. And in Scotland, I was attached to a special service group, which was the earlier form of commandos, as a direction-finding operator. So my job was to carry a sort of radio, about twice as big as that, with a DF aerial on, and the whole thing marked out in directions, so that as I turned him round, I pinpointed the radio station. Two of you operating together, several hundred yards apart, could in fact pinpoint the, not the sending station, but the sending area. But we were both attached to this, like a commando group in Scotland, and we were on a ship in Loch Fyne.
Which ship?
I don't know the name of the ship. No, we were on a small ship in Loch Fyne. And we used to go out on exercises with this ship. We go ashore in landing craft and then practice this direction finding. It was a very primitive sort of thing, you know. Because all that you had to do was to swing the thing round until the signal disappeared. You get the signal at its strongest, and then you got your signal to disappear. And we went out on one of these, and I'm not sure whether it was the real thing. They said that we were going to invade Norway and try and pinpoint this heavy water place. And whether we did or not, I don't know. But we went ashore, and I went ashore with them, and we tramped through them. Through the wet forests and so on, and I spent about 2 days in a ditch, and had to be carried home, went in hospital again. And when I came out of hospital, I was graded C. I'd had a chest infection, and it left me very deaf, and so I was graded C. So I went back to Trowbridge. And in Trowbridge, they didn't know what to do with me. So they put me in the cookhouse washing dishes. And I had a lovely job. There were no dishes for breakfast to wash because it was only the cooking pots I had to wash. The men had to wash their own dishes. I just washed the cooking pots. And after lunch, I used to go out and pick flowers for the cooks and sleep on my bunk. And then at tea time, I used to put the lay the tables with the lumps of cheese or the lumps of whatever it was with the bread and the margarine on the tables, and that was a lovely job. And I kept that for quite a few weeks. I started writing poetry. I met Alan Shillitoe, and we started writing stories, short stories together. And then one day I was told that I had to go to Bristol for an interview. So off I went to Bristol as an interview. They gave me a lot of tests, and they finished up by saying, right, you're promoted sergeant, and tomorrow you're going to London to the War Office, and you're a PSS sergeant in London. And that's what happened.
PSS?
Personnel Selection Sergeant.
You told me that you got a bad report on leaving the army. Was that anything to do with Spain?
The point was that I got quite a few bad reports. The first part of the job as a personnel selection sergeant was to administer the Raven Matrix test to recruits coming into the army. If you've never seen a matrix test, I've got one over there, I'll show it to you afterwards. It's a non-verbal intelligence test. And we gave this to all recruits at the recruiting centre.